to episode 363 of Cinematary. I'm your host, Zach Dennis, and I'm here with
Andrew Swafford,
Michael O'Malley.
In today's episode, we'll be talking about movies that we saw this week in part one, and in part two, we will be continuing our Young Critics Watch Old Movies series with 1949's Jour de Fête, which we're jumping back into Jour.
Is it not Jour? Jour? I thought it had a little bit of je to it.
I guess I just didn't like, want to like go. I didn't want to like. Vie. Yeah, I didn't want to just jump in with just like immediately offensive French. So I could be like Jour de Fête.
Jesse, I just want to say that I was watching the end of Jour de Fête, and Jesse came in and got the like Flight of the Conchords making fun of French song stuck in her head and started playing that for me. So maybe we cut that in the middle, the beginning of part two.
That'll be the middle song. You know, we'll just do that.
Baguette.
But yeah, but we're gonna jump into some Tati land in part two. Head over to cinematary.com though. We talked about it last week, but we got Space Jam 2. We still got Pig, so some good stuff over there.
New essay coming out Monday about the new Fast and Furious movie from one Logan Kinney.
That's always one you got to check out. So there you go. Some fun news before we jump into part one, though. I'm gonna toss it over to Andrew because we got some cool festival news this week.
Yeah,
or last week.
Film festivals are back. I know we're not totally out of the woods in terms of COVID stuff, at least for the unvaccinated people. You should get vaccinated, by the way, if you're not vaccinated.
Yeah, you should get, we're firm on
Jesus
that train.
Jesus Christ, get vaccinated.
Stop listening to us if you're not vaccinated.
We're pro-involuntary vaccines. We're Antifa coming to your house and giving you vaccines.
Sticking a syringe in your arm, yeah. But anyways, film festivals are back. We are going back to TIFF, which is exciting. We did cover TIFF last year, but it was Zach, sadly and forlornly, covering TIFF from his bedroom on a laptop, watching movies
my
on some probably shoddy streaming service.
My living room, and I watched it on... They had an Apple TV app, okay? It wasn't like I was... I mean, come on.
This time, we got the plane tickets, we got the Airbnb, we're gonna get on public transit, we're gonna walk in the theater, we're gonna see the movies, and it's gonna be... It's just me and Zach, which is a smaller number of people than we have had in the past, but a little peek behind the curtain here, it's a larger number of media passes than we have had in the past. In the past, it has always been Zach gets to see all the like cool industry screenings, and me and whoever else have to pay our way to watch the other screenings that are open to the public. But now me and Zach are both getting free industry passes, so I'm very excited about that.
Bodes well
for the future of Cinematary.
I'm excited about it because I don't like talking in those lines.
Yeah, it's gotta be lonely.
I don't want to like. It's just I don't know. I don't want to get into it, I guess.
Have you
I just kind of look around, I'm like,
do you do much like celebrity spotting of like, oh, I know that film critic, or I know that film Twitter personality?
Well, that's the thing, is it's like, oh, I know that person from Twitter. And I'm like, I can't be like, hey, I know you from Twitter.
Because that sounds fucking weird.
I did, last time we were there in person, I ran into Slash Films' Chris Evangelista.
Which you know personally from outside of Twitter. Yeah.
Yeah, I've talked to him on my other when the newsreel was happening. So I do know him, but I'd never met him in person. So I felt like, let me just introduce myself to you. But I've seen people from Twitter, and it's weird to be like, hey, I know you from Twitter.
So if anyone is listening to this and knows us from Twitter and wants
please
to say hi,
yeah, please say hello. Yeah. We're very friendly. I'm just not gonna like come up to you and be like, oh, I know you from Twitter. So if you do that, I'll be super nice to you and be like, of course, that's awesome. Let's go and get a beer and talk about movies. So yeah, check it out. We'll be there watching stuff the 9th through the 13th. So be following the Cinematary account and Andrew's Twitter account. We'll be talking about stuff. And then if you follow us on Instagram and Facebook, we'll have some like little diaries coming out on the daily as
Man,
well.
I miss the morning TIFF diaries. We're bringing them back.
It's
can't wait.
It's nice. We're all half asleep, barely cognizant, and giving, you know, just random opinions on movies. It's great. It's fun time. We'll have to get Michael sometime. Michael, stop having kids and come to TIFF.
Yeah, I'll work on that.
All right, well, let's talk about the I'm gonna call it the movie of the moment, because I mean, who was really going out to see I forgot what the big movie was last week. I think
It was Space Jam, actually.
It's Space Jam, exactly. Nobody was going to see Space Jam.
I feel like that movie's been out for months.
Maybe 2 weeks? I don't know.
But last week, the latest... Well, this one's been kind of puttering around. It's kind of been like the big A24 release that they've been sitting on. I think it was supposed to come out last year, but they held on to it for a year. And that is the latest from David Lowery, who did Ain't Nobody Saints, Pete's Dragon, Ghost Story. But his latest is The Green Knight, which... is a adaptation, you know, it kind of is a fun adaptation, an adaptation of the Arthurian legend of, is it Sir Gawain?
Sir Gawain.
Gawain. Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. Sir Gawain's played by Dev Patel. It also stars Alicia Vikander, Joel Edgerton, and Sean Harris, and a little creepy...
And both of the parents from The Witch are in it.
Yeah, which is kind of funny. It's like they're just... Yeah. Which they also... Just aside, they also starred together in Star Wars The Last Jedi, so I don't know what that says.
Well, we don't have to talk about that. But the dad from The Witch has one of the greatest voices of all time, and he voices the titular Green Knight, and it is marvelous.
But for those who are unfamiliar with the story, the Green Knight comes. He sets a challenge in front of King Arthur. Sir Gawain takes it, and we have this long, epic fantasy quest that we go on for the rest of the movie.
And how long has it been since we had a movie with a quest in it?
Honestly, I was good with just like the whole quest aspect of it. I'm like, I like a good quest. but all three of us saw it, so. Andrew, I'm going to start with you because I know that you just actually reread the story. What did you make of The Green Knight?
Read the story, actually. I had never read it before, which is shocking because it's a story that's taught in like almost every high school in America. And I attended high school in America and also have taught senior English many times in America, but have never been asked to read or been asked to teach this story. So I finally caught up with it. I read the Tolkien translation, which is in verse. I'm not sure if they're all in verse or not, but it's tough. Tolkien was a scholar of like Anglo-Saxon and Arthurian, like early literary texts. Like he's actually the reason why Beowulf is like a household name, is that Tolkien popularized it. But his translations of those texts, he has a translation of Gawain and a translation of Beowulf, are both really hard to read in general. But I still really enjoyed the story. It has like a great, like ominous tone to it. And I really liked the movie too. It takes some liberties with the story. I will say that it, not to spoil what happens at the end, but I will say it changes the ending in a significant way that like totally changes how the story reads, because the original story is meant as a Christian parable, and at the end of the story, like the original version, people probably know this from high school class, like there's kind of a Jesus figure who reveals themselves and kind of like redeems Sir Gawain, right? And you don't get that here. And it's very a-religious or amoral, you might say. It certainly is like very ambiguous about how it wants you to feel about the actions taken by the characters. But a lot of the things that are changed are additions to the story. The original story is very compact. It kind of like focuses on one individual conflict. Like Sir Gawain is on his way to meet the Green Knight, who has vowed to kill him, and he's going to go allow himself to be killed by the Green Knight as like a token of honor or something. And so he has to like walk all the way across the country to get to the Green Knight. And in the story, it's like, so he walked and he got there, you know, like, or he gets to a castle and he stays at the castle for several days. And there's some temptations and stuff at the castle that are significant. But for the most part, you don't see Sir Gawain on the road. And in this one, you see Sir Gawain on the road, and like it becomes this episodic story of like all the little stops that he makes and all the little things that he runs into. And this is kind of just room for David Lowry to play around with like phantasmagorical fantasy imagery. And I thought that the stuff that was added was really cool. Like, I don't know if it's necessarily essential to the story that's being told here, but like some of my favorite parts of the story are just like these little short stories that are inserted halfway through Sir Gawain's story. And they're always shot in really interesting, colorful, eerie ways. And there's a little bit of like slow cinema stuff in there too. I would not go as far as to say The Green Knight itself is slow cinema, though David Lowry's previous movie, A Ghost Story, I certainly would. But there's definitely a lot of what you might call like shoe leather in the movie. Like there are shots of just Sir Gawain walking from one end of a hill to another. And I was at a professional development earlier this week. Michael was there too, for teacher in service. And I heard some teachers, talking about the movie because of course teachers know Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, and they're always, you know, they'll always go out and watch the latest literary adaptation of anything they're teaching.
They like some Arthurian legend.
Yeah, I mean, they're nerds, right? But like I heard teachers whining about how slow and boring this movie was.
To be fair, I have seen like certified like cinephile Letterboxd users complaining of the same thing. So
I think those people are more complaining about like some sort of imagined idea of like empty A24 pretentiousness that I think they're just kind of making into a scapegoat or a straw man of some sort because you gotta be contrarian.
I would like to address some of the A24 stuff, but we can do that later.
Yeah. We can do that later. I'm very pro A24, even though I am irritated by their marketing every now and then. But in general, like, even though this movie has moments that like really bring the pacing down, I don't think that that's in a bad way, right? Like, it's just showing you this journey, and there are highs and lows of the journey. It really gives you a sense of like the arduousness of a task like this. Tellingly, the scene where Sir Gawain leaves the round table or the court where the round table is to go off on his quest. We don't just see a shot of him riding out of the gates on his horse and then we hard cut to the first thing he runs across. His horse walks out of the gate and we follow that horse for a long time as like a bunch of kids from the town who are like, you know, are excited about this new adventure that this famous person in their town is going on are like following him. And like it just keeps following him to give you the sense of like, this is somebody having to like travel across the country by foot. And he's also doing it in order to like meet his certain death. Like he's deciding, I am going to go allow myself to be killed. And he has to sit with that feeling every single step of the way. He doesn't get to just fast forward to the moment when it happens. And that makes the task, I feel like, feel much more, monumental than it might otherwise. In general, we can kind of get into interpretation stuff later if you guys want to, but my main takeaway is that it's a really good time and it's a lot of really cool stuff to look at. I enjoyed it on that very like lizard brain nerd boy level of like, I want to see cool fantasy shit shot in a very interesting way.
Michael, what'd you make of it?
I also really liked it. And it does look extremely cool. Something Andrew talked about a little bit, but something that I was just like constantly just mesmerized with in the movie is the like the texture of the objects on screen, like the costuming and then like locations or I assume some of this is probably in a studio, but a lot of it is outdoors and very like, you know, textured. And then the clothes all these are wearing, like I'm not enough of a historical expert to know if it's like period appropriate to like the, you know, medieval whatever, but it looks extremely cool and it is like extremely like full of different things to look at. Like King Arthur, for example, and Guinevere are wearing these like robes that have like plaques and badges all over them. And so, like, as they're just sitting there, like, all these, like, they're like, subtly, like, making noises as they, like, shuffle their clothing. Like,
the
these, like,
sound
clinking
is
metal.
Really textured, too. Yeah. And, like, the weapons sound like they're heavy in a way that I feel like swords and stuff never sound in most movies.
Yeah, so, like, it's extremely... I agree, it's extremely cool to look at. Really interesting and, like, mesmerizing camera work and lighting, as well as just, like, how the sets and locations interplay with, like, the characters' costumes and stuff like that. So I really like that. And I think that this is, like, really thematically interesting, too. It reminds me a lot of the Robert Zemeckis Beowulf movie, not in terms of style, which, like, those two movies are extremely different in style, with, like, Zemeckis Beowulf being, like, really kinetic and whatever. But, like, as far as, like, what, like, their relationship to their source material, which I've not read Sir Gawain and the Green Knight in, like, a long time, so I don't remember it as sharply as Andrew does, but I remember enough of it to, like, kind of appreciate, like, this movie's relationship with its source material, which, like, both of the movies essentially are taking, like, source material that is, like, not simple, but has, like, a pretty, like, it's basically both of the movies' worldviews, like, are directly in conversation with the worldviews of the original text rather than simply recreating the original text, you know. So with Beowulf, you know, a lot of the original text of Beowulf is in, like, how heroic and strong Beowulf is, and possibly the limitations of that. It's, like, slightly alluded to in the original poem. And then the movie just, like, hammers right into that and makes Beowulf this incredibly flawed figure and it has, like, national consequences, like, some of the things that he's done. And, like, a lot of people really hate that adaptation of Beowulf, not just because of the, like, weird motion capture, but also because it, like, is genuinely, like, tearing apart the original story and, like, the kind of ethos of the original story. And, like, I think in a certain way, this movie kind of does a similar thing with Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, which is that, like, whereas, like, the original story is about chivalry and, like, this knight doing stuff out of, like, honor codes and, like, how, you know, oh, can he achieve the honor codes of, like, you know, that are expected of him and things like that. Like, that's what the original text is about. And then this movie is basically starting from the premise that those honor codes are merely performance in a lot of ways. And so, like, for instance, like, the movie opens, like, it's not the first shot of the movie, but it's, like, a very early shot in the movie where we see this lady and a man get on a horse next to, like, a burning building. It looks like there's maybe been some sort of violence or something like that. And they ride off and, you know, kind of, like, looking like a kind of chivalric, heroic moment. But then the camera zooms back and we see that we've been watching that through a window of a brothel. And then we zoom back and see, like, Dev Patel, our supposed hero, like, waking up after a night in a brothel. It's Christmas and he, like, runs to mass, like, after having, you know.
And Sir Gawain, crucially, in the story, like, his defining character trait is he does not fuck. Like, he does not have sex with anyone ever.
There's
like,
a lot of
what makes him a hero. And in this
that
one,
is absolutely not the case
with,
in this
he
movie.
Just got done having sex.
No. So, like, from the premise, like, from the very beginning, like, this movie is, like, questioning the idea that chivalry is anything but, like, something that is performed. And there's, like, a quote, and there's something someone says that I'm going to paraphrase, because I can't remember the exact thing, but, like, essentially, like, someone is talking about, like, Sir Gawain wants to be a great knight. And someone says, like, well, why would you want to be a great knight when you could just be, like, a good person or something like that? Like, do you remember that?
Yeah. Yes, it's the Alicia Vikander peasant woman who says it. Yeah.
Right. The sex worker that he's with at the beginning and is kind of a love interest a little bit. And so, like, the whole movie is that tension where to become, like, what is considered great in that society requires a sort of performance of acts that are perhaps require the sacrifice of you being a genuine and an honest person and a good person in a certain sense. And I think that that's really interesting. And I know that, like, some people are saying that, like, well, this is like I've seen some people whose opinions I respect and, you know, who are clearly coming from a place of love of the original saying, like, well, this is just like 21st century, like, you know, arrogance, like revisionism of like a complex text into like, you know, kind of like, you know, social justice ideas in the 21st century or whatever. Like, and
this movie does not scream like social justice issue movie to me.
Not that, but like the idea that like the like avatars of goodness are like must be morally complicated and there are power structures at play, you know, that idea. And like, I don't think that that's necessarily wrong to say that like this is a revision of like an older text from a distinctly 21st century lens, but like, I don't think that that's a bad thing. You know, like the world of literature is full of revisions of older texts. You know, you have stuff like The White Sargasso Sea, which does a post-colonial reading of Jane Eyre. You have like The Aeneid, which is like a Roman gloss on the Iliad in a certain way. And...
Well, Beowulf is a revision of the oral story of Beowulf. Like, it's this Christian monk writing down this pagan story and like constantly talking shit about this supposed hero, Beowulf. So
yeah,
like,
exactly.
Well,
so like, I love movies
tradition.
That are like in like part of that like process of adaptation in which there's like a self-consciousness about the adaptation. That is the case here for sure. And like Andrew, I really liked the stuff that they added and I thought that was cool. And another thing that's cool is despite the film being episodic, like there is this kind of running through line of like this kind of question is like, you know, what is the character of Dev Patel and what is he going to do in order to become what he wants to become? And what does that say about his character? And like all of the stories that he, you know, he is kind of presented with sort of traditional like knight things, you know, like he has to like engage with supernatural creatures and like at one point he has to perform rescues a maiden and things like that, but like he doesn't do them in a way like the way that his character performs these quests, there's always an ambiguity of like how well has he actually performed this quest, because the outcomes are not always like very cleanly like signaling that like yes, he has accomplished his quest and has done the right thing. And I think that's really interesting. You know, it's, I thought like it was a really interesting movie stylistically. And then the thematically, it's like really interesting to pull apart and think about. And there's like elements of the movie I would probably have to rewatch and think about some more to decide like what's going on there. Cause it is in some ways like a puzzling movie. Like there's things like shots and stuff that you're given that it's kind of unclear like what we're supposed to be getting out of them and stuff like that. But like, I think that it, overall, was a really great and interesting and rewarding movie to watch, for me at least. And I'm a little bit surprised to see it become as divisive as it is, because it has in some ways become a divisive movie. And both among, like for instance, Andrew and I saw this movie together with some of their friends, and like our group was fairly split as far as like, you know, who liked it and who didn't. And then I've seen And I assume that was, you know, because some people were like more into like the kind of like art film kind of thing that David Lowery is doing than other people. But then I've seen other people, you know, who definitely don't have that, you know, reticence about like art films, also dislike this movie. And it does seem to be pretty divisive.
Well, one of your friends who didn't like it loved A Ghost Story, which is much slower than this.
Yeah.
So it's not just like, are you used to slow paced movies?
So I think it's interesting that it's become so contentious, but I thought it was really good.
I was going to say, sorry, Zach. I was just going to say that, like, you mentioned that you wanted to rewatch it to kind of pull it apart a little bit further. And I have had a lot of friends go back to watch it a second time. And one particular friend watched it three times in the theater, which I think speaks to the way the movie kind of invites you to return to that world and think about this a little harder. But, Zach, what are you guys saying?
I'm somebody who's in the I'm more of like a David Lowery fan than I would say like an A24 like house style fan, and I feel like this kind of threads the line between like the two. You know, there's moments in it that were really, really evocative. I'm trying to think of like the specific thing, but like the part, I love the scene where he eats the mushrooms, and then it's not really like a psychedelic scene, but it's just like
giants.
It has like this like green. Yeah, like the giants and like the green hue, like it reminded me of like, it was much more interesting than just being kind of like the psychedelic scene. But then you have scenes like, like, I really couldn't get into the whole bandit scene, the one with Barry Keoghan from Killing of a Sacred Deer, because that whole sequence just screamed to me, like, kind of, unfortunately, it just felt like I would see this in another A24 movie. It's specifically like a Yorgos Lanthimos. Like, it reminded me of something like From the Lobster or Killing of a Sacred Deer, where it's just...
Would you be saying that if it wasn't Barry Keoghan in the role?
Yes, I would. I would. But it was more like the way that the way he moves the camera around also is just... It feels very like... the camera's kind of on a swivel, and it's like it's watching from that way.
It reminded me more of like the scene where he first meets Barry Keoghan, and they're walking along the like corpse field, and Barry Keoghan gives him directions. It reminded me honestly of Mizoguchi, and like that scene good. In yeah. Story of the Last Chrysanthemums, where like the main character and his love interest are like walking on that riverbank, and it's like a single unbroken shot of them walking from one end to the other, and it's like 3 minutes.
And
or
he
something.
Has the camera far back; it's a wide shot.
Yeah,
exactly. That one's good, but then once they get in the woods, it becomes I don't know. Like, and that's why. So I'm kind of torn on this movie. I liked a lot of it. I like Lowry. I think he's a really good editor. He does. I think he really like the way he edits movies. Like he are like, at least in my opinion, he has the best live action Disney adaptation with Pete's Dragon. Like, that thing is so much better than a lot of the other live action adaptations that Disney's made. But with this one, I don't know. I'm hit or miss. I think a lot of it does come down to just the A24 brand, unfortunately. And like, I like a lot of A24 movies, so it seems a little hypocritical of me to be like, you know, rolling my eyes at it. But I also think just the way that they market themselves and the way that they market their house style, you know, it's...
Well, can I push back a little bit on that? Because Michael and I have been talking about this week as, like, he's kind of come across a lot of detractions online from people who, like, are getting in, I don't know, irritated with A24 at this point. And, like, I would argue that A24... Like, it's not fair to say that A24 has a house style, because they're not a production company. They're a distribution company. Like, these are people who are making movies with other companies and with their own visions, and A24 is just finding them and elevating them, right? And I think that if you look at the list of what movies come out from A24, like, the styles can vary pretty wildly. I mean, there are a couple that you can put next to each other and you can see similarities with, like, The Witch and It Comes at Night and stuff like that. But also, you got to remember things like Claire Denis' High Life came out, and Augustine Frizzell's Never Going Back came out on A24. And, like, a lot of these movies couldn't be more different from one another.
I'm wondering, Zach, like, could I get you to clarify a little bit? So you mentioned the specific scene in The Green Knight that you felt like was like very A24, and so, like, I mean, given that like A24 didn't produce it themselves, like, what do you think's going on there? Like, is David Lowery like kind of absorbing like the kind of like general, like, I guess, has A24 elevated certain stylistic devices that then are now like recurring in like other productions, like, as like self-consciously, or is he like specifically thinking like, oh, this might get picked up by A24, so I better like, you know, kind of conform to that. Like, when people say house style, I guess I'm wondering what they mean. Because, like Andrew said,
and at least in this regard, he probably had some, because A24 also distributed A Ghost Story. So, I mean, he has a relationship with him, and so I'm sure that they probably had some deal with him that he was going to make movies for. And I understand that they're not a production company; they're a distributor, but. At the same time, and this is not, I guess this would not be their fault. It's not like they're consciously making this decision, but there's definitely a type of movie fan today, predominantly in our age range and younger,
teenagers.
who very much engages with A24 at, you know, in the same realm as like a Marvel fan would be or something like that, where there's like, they really like, there's just an obsession with the brand. And so that's why I said
there are people who collect them and have like A24 shelves, like you have a Criterion shelf in your house if you have a
Criterion shelf. I'm completely oblivious to this. Is like, I've never heard of that before.
It's very prevalent. I mean, I run up against it a lot just through film TikTok. I mean, it's very prevalent there, where that's kind of the age range.
And on,
that's
like, gonna, the movies Reddit, for example, is another.
These are places I've never heard of.
And so that's, like that's what I wanted to, like, again, like this one, there's nothing wrong with it, you know, like it's so technically, but there's something. There's something that those A24 fans are looking for in a movie that like validates it. Not even being like an A24 movie, but like this is like they're young cinephiles to a large extent. Like that's how they're processing what a quality or a good movie is, and there's nothing wrong with that either. But it's like there's kind of a baseline of like what they look for, and it seems like. To me, I get tired of seeing that, like, that hit on every movie.
I know what you're saying, and I think that you're definitely right in that, like, a certain age of film fan or a certain, like, level of experience of film fan is bound to pick up on certain signifiers and think, oh, this is an artistic movie, or this is a high-quality movie because it has, like, bold color or symmetry or whatever, like these things that tend to stand in for artsy movie.
They try during the editing compared to other stuff, you know. I get it, like it's true, you know.
But I would say that, like, to a certain extent, we're kind of like hating the band for the fans here,
sure.
I'm open about that.
I'm just saying.
It does clarify, though. Yeah. Like, until you guys just said this, I had no clue that there was any such like fandom for A24, and it does clarify the because for me, I would read these like, you know, multi paragraph screeds about A24 inside of reviews of The Green Knight on Letterboxd or whatever, and I just thought like I didn't understand, like, where was this coming from? And now that I understand that there's, like, this is in some way a reaction against, like, people who are irritatingly, like, cheerleaders for this specific, like, type of movie, like, I guess I understand that a little bit more.
Well, like, you know what it... Honestly, and I'm not accusing you of this, Zach, but honestly, it feels to me like gatekeeping. These are young people who are excited about film, and they've found films that are outside of the main, quote-unquote, mainstream, and that they're not getting produced by, like, the biggest, like, the four or five biggest studios in the world. And they're excited by the possibilities of that. And, you know, people who have been in the film game a little bit longer are looking at this, like, young enthusiasm, which was the case for us when we started this podcast, and saying like, oh, you people don't know what real film is. Get out of here with your like fake deep pretentiousness.
And I'll clarify that also, like, yeah, I'm trying my best not, because I really don't blame those fans for that. You know, it's just, unfortunately, I'm about to wade into the Scorsese discourse, but I think unfortunately, just the way that movies are produced now, you have a lot of house styles, you know, like it's like every like stuff is produced under usually a banner. It's, you know, I think even something like Neon is getting that way now, and it's kind of the same with A24, where it's more of a distributor.
They're chasing the A24 image,
sure. Yeah, but it's like you kind of have like these like production distributor banners that stuff is under, and that's all over the place. I mean, that's how blockbusters are made, under Disney, under Warner Brothers. I mean, we talked about it last week with Warner Brothers, Marvel, Star Wars, and that's just kind of the way it is now. So that's why I don't fault them for getting attracted to that, because unfortunately that's the only way movies are being made now. So that's, and so I think what I was struggling with coming out of this is I really would have loved this movie if it was able to just kind of stand on its own and be detached from all of that. And that's not the fault of the movie, that's not the fault of David Lowery, it's not the fault of A24, it's just like the nature of the business. And so I have to get over that, but I think that that's just more like the nature of the movie business, that everything has to be under a banner now, because that's how we're processing movies. This isn't like the 70s where like Warner Brothers can put out a movie, but you're not watching that movie going, this is a Warner Brothers production necessarily.
And we've had this conversation with Darren on the podcast, I think. I don't remember if it was on mic or off mic, but he was talking about how like in his day, like when he was a much younger dude getting into movies, it was Miramax was this distribution company.
Yeah, right? That was kind of the first one.
And I would say, and I mean, I wasn't around when Miramax were having their like indie heyday, but I would say that like the hit rate for actual good movies for A24 is probably a little higher than the hit rate for Miramax.
I feel like we should wait a couple of decades, because I think at the time people perceived a higher hit rate at Miramax, and then in like later on, like no one cares as much for like some of the.
But regardless of whether what's better, Miramax or A24, like I appreciate a company like Miramax or a company like A24 that is putting, you know, movies that aren't, you know, big studio produced out and finding innovative ways to do them. Like A24 is kind of a master at marketing to a fault. Like again, I've gotten irritated with A24's marketing. I don't know if you guys have seen the marketing for this movie Lamb they're coming out with, and it just feels like I've seen this movie five times before.
We're gonna have this discussion again for Lamb, because the Lamb looks worse in that regard than
it's
Green
Knight.
It's
like, let's make this into a meme about a cute animal and like a weird gimmicky horror plot, like high concept horror plot, and like the movie could very well be great. But I've seen this like marketing cycle a billion times. But that's the brilliance of A24, the thing that they've latched onto. They've found a way to get really bizarre, like non-mainstream audience friendly movies into fucking multiplexes, and they coast off of the energy of people who hate the movies. Like The Witch got a fucking F cinema score, and that got people talking about it, and it ended up doing really well. And it doesn't matter that a lot of mainstream audiences didn't like it, but a movie like The Witch got a really wide distribution. It made a lot of money, and Robert Eggers got to make another movie, right? And so like there's a lot of filmmakers who I guess you could argue like it's a sad state of the film industry that like this is the only company where filmmakers can really turn to get that sort of exposure with outside of being part of the Disney machine or whatever. But
or even like a net, you know, you could go to Netflix
could, but like Netflix actually does have a house style, and that they make you use style. Certain cameras and shit. A24 doesn't do that, right? Like Uncut Gems doesn't look like this movie. They look very, very different. And like this is a company that's actually letting artists pursue a vision and distributing that vision, and like allowing directors who otherwise wouldn't be able to work in the system at all to flourish in the system. Like Michael, you and I were talking about, like Paul Schrader has talked very openly about not being able to get movies financed, but like A24 got First Reformed out there, and it's one of the best movies of the decade.
but we're starting to blur the line between distribution and production again, though, because when you say A24 allowed these movies to happen, like A24 distributed these movies. But I guess, so if I'm going to play devil's advocate here, there is maybe an argument to be made that in the same way that Disney or Netflix kind of like vacuums up content to then repackage as their own, like, could you not say the same thing about A24, who takes movies that are the hard work? Well, a lot of the hard work has been done in the sense of like the movie is made, right? And they are vacuuming them up to consolidate into like their A24 package, right? Like, which I don't really have a problem with, because in my head, like this is just how film distribution works in like a capitalist society, right? Like there's like that element of exploitation that is wrong, but I don't know that A24 is doing anything unique. But I'm wondering if like, you know, when we say like, for instance, like, you know, Paul Schrader has trouble getting his movies financed. Like, does A24 actually help him get his movies financed? I mean, they distributed First Reformed, right? But they didn't make First Reformed for him or pay him to make First Reformed. So, you know, it's like a chicken and egg thing. Like, would First Reformed have had like the broad reception if it had been distributed by Neon or Grasshopper or, you know, whatever. I don't know.
Yeah, and the last thing I'll say, like, I like this movie. Like, I kind of want to go see it again because I think I'll find more in it, like, a second time through. I don't know. I think it's just the nice thing is to Andrew's point that, I mean, this did play at a multiplex. You know, The Witch played at a multiplex. Hereditary's played at a multiplex. Zola was playing at multiplexes a couple weeks ago. You know, that is, and that
High Life played at multiplexes. That is a bizarre, upsetting fucking movie.
Yeah. So I mean that, and so I don't know. I it's just more. It's just the way things are. I'll get over it. It'll be fine. I'm trying not to be a curmudgeon about it. I'm just saying that, like, I came out of it and I was like, I like this, but I feel like there's just this cloud hanging over it, and that's, you know, that is what it is. But The Green Knight, it's in theaters now. I reckon it's a good time. If you're kind of looking for something that's not Black Widow, or I don't know if you want to watch Matt Damon do a Oklahoma accent. If you're not into that, you got The Green Knight.
Shit's bleak.
It's a bleak time. Bleak, I don't. all right, we're gonna take a quick break though, and then we'll be back talking a little Postman Jacques Tati after this.
Hello, Cinematary listeners. This is your favorite Filipino podcaster, Jessica Carr. I'm here to let you know about a couple of things that Cinematary offers that you might not know about. First, if you're a fan of what Cinematary is doing, please consider joining us on Patreon. Remember when we weren't clamoring for your dollars? Well, now we're just clamoring for five of your dollars. So please help us and donate to our Patreon, and then you'll get exclusive content from our staff, including our film theory and chill series, where a panel takes a piece of theory each month and deconstructs it before diving into whatever topic is on their mind from the past week. The $5 each month is an investment in the website and the podcast, and it goes solely to paying our writers for the reviews each week, so please consider doing it. It's only $5. If you missed an episode of Cinematary or a piece of writing we've had, you should consider signing up for our free newsletter. Each Sunday, we send out a note with the latest podcast episode, piece of Patreon content, and the last two reviews that we've written at cinematary.com. It's perfect for those of you who are interested in what's happening, and it makes sure that you don't miss a single Cinematary review. Finally, the easiest thing that you can do to help us is to please, please give us a rating and review on iTunes, Spotify, or whatever else you're using to listen to the show. This helps us get more eyeballs and ears on the podcast and the website, and it helps the people know about Cinematary, which is really what we're here for. So to recap, consider donating to our Patreon, sign up for the free newsletter, and give us a rating or review. We would really appreciate if you could do these things. Thank you for listening, and now back to the show.
Je suis enchanté. Voilà mon passeport. Ah, Gérald Depardieu. Baguette.
Baguette.
Foudou fa-fa. Foudou fa-fa-fa-fa. Foudou fa-fa. Aïe. Foudou fa-fa. Foudou fa-fa-fa-fa.
Et maintenant le voyage à la soupe à mâcher. Comme la mousse, ananas, jus d'orange, bœuf, soupe de jour.
And we're back with part two of episode 363 of Cinematary. In this part, we will be continuing our Young Critics Watch Old Movies series with 1949's Jour de Fête, directed by Jacques Tati, from a script by Tati, Henri Marquette, and René Wheeler. The film stars Tati, Guy Decombe, and Paul Francoeur. In a small French town, the local postman, scatterbrained and bumbling Francois, spends his working hours casually delivering the mail while being the subject of the townsfolk's teasing. When a traveling carnival arrives in town, a drunken Francois is goaded into watching a film depicting the efficiency of the U.S. Postal Service. Inspired by the footage, the hapless Francois sets out on his bicycle to become just like the mail carriers in the United States. Jour de Fête was an expanded version of an 18-minute film Tati had made shortly after World War II, L'École des Facteurs, which is translated into School of Postmen, from 1947, features many of the same gags that would later appear in this film with little variation. Tati mounted the production with the help of producer Fred O'Rain, who raised approximately $30,000 from two investors. In remaking the short film, Tati returned to the location that inspired the film, Saint-Sever. A soldier in the French army, Tati had lived in the town during the latter years of World War II, avoiding Nazi persecution during the German occupation of Paris. The film established a pattern Tati followed throughout his career, using non-professionals instead of established actors, including the town priest and the owner of the local hotel. Not every cast member was enthralled by the idea of a film being shot in their humble hamlet. Quote, "The cinema's all very well," said Saint-Severian Marie Vallée, "but when there are five of you at home and cooking to be done and mending and what's more, three cows, two sows, hens, and ducks to be looked after, there's not much time for larking about." Which is true of most things. Tati planned for Jour de Fête to be the first French feature film to be shot and released in color. He employed the experimental Thompson color system, the results of which were difficult to predict. To cover himself in the event of technological issues, Tati also shot the film in black and white. This proved to be a wise decision, since Tati was dissatisfied with the quality of the color release prints and released the film in black and white instead. Quote, "In those immediate post-war years, film stock was scarce and often of poor quality," says James Harding in the book Jacques Tati, Frame by Frame. "The electricity supply frequently broke down. His equipment was extremely modest. Despite these handicaps, the 4 months that Jour de Fête took to make were months of gaiety and enthusiasm, not least on part of the Saint-Severians or Folinvillians, as they were known in the film. Upon the completion of the film, a special screening was held in Saint-Sever, preceded by a parade through the village led by Tati, his producer, and the town's mayor. As part of the festivities, the townspeople dedicated a plaster bust of Francois the postman. Years later, a street was dedicated to the filmmaker, Rue Jacques Tati. After initial screenings of the film, he shot a few additional scenes, including one in which Francois bursts into a man's house to make a delivery. Seeing the man is dressed in black, he voices his enthusiasm for the festival, assuming this is the reason for his formal attire. Then Francois exits and the door closes to reveal a corpse lying in state. Still not satisfied with this original release. So it is a good gag. Still not satisfied with this original release version of Jour de Fête, Tati shot new material and re-edited the film for a 1964 theatrical re-release and added some jazzy new instrumentation to the sound mix. Determined that his provincial comedy should have some splashes of color, he employed the Scopachrome LAC system to strategically colorize his film. Tati introduces this idea within the film by showing an artist painting a picture of the town. As his brushes touch paper, small details of the town, a flag, a banner, the decorations of a carousel, suddenly appear in color. In some of these shots, portions of the film were hand-colored in a style reminiscent of the Pathé color stencil process of the silent era. In other instances, color elements such as a string of pennants were optically superimposed over the black and white image. In 1952, the New York Times said, "Since the French movie men have acquired an honest reputation for suave comedy, it must be explained that they may upset all previous conceptions with Jour de Fête, which makes a completely unseemly bid for the mantle of Max in it." 1952, Time magazine called Tati's character, quote, a sad face, gangling rural postman who looks like a cross between General Charles de Gaulle and old time silent comic Charlie Chase. But really, the most important review comes from Buster Keaton, who said Tati carries on from the point where we left off some 40 years ago.
Bless.
And on that note, right? Yeah, who gives a shit what fucking New York Times said? Buster Keaton is giving reviews.
There are like Keaton gags in this movie too, like the thing with the bicycle on the like little train stopper thing.
It's like true.
Just lifted out of Sherlock Jr. Yeah.
So that, let's talk a little bit about Jour de Fête. Michael, we'll come to you last since you're the Tati newbie. Do you want to start with him?
I think we should go to Michael first. All
right, never mind. Okay. Michael, you're kicking us off.
Start with Michael. Yeah.
Okay, so I signed up for this to watch this movie because I had never seen a Jacques Tati movie before, and I'm like, well, this is a big blind spot, and this is a good like excuse to watch one. What I didn't realize going in, because I didn't research this at all, was that this is his debut, and this is often, it's not like his usual character that he plays, and so like perhaps this wasn't the best entry into his filmography, because I found this...
It's how everybody else entered. So.
If you look at the criterion,
Buster Keaton.
If you look
good.
At the criterion spines, which I'm certain is how many good. People enter now, is not the first. But at any rate, like I spent the first two thirds of this movie being like, I thought this was a comedy. Like this feels like this. It felt like in terms of like. What it was doing as far as like with plot and stuff like that, it felt like if Italian neorealism had happened without World War, like before World War II, and we were just seeing the quaint towns before they had been ravaged by war, right? And so it's just like meandering around town and kind of lightly comic stuff is happening, but it's not like super funny. It's just like kind of like, oh, he's got to deliver the mail, but he's stopping to bale hay or whatever. And I guess like I didn't really understand, like I thought Tati was this like really like modernist, like kind of elaborate guy. And this is like really provincial and like naturalistic in ways that like I found I just wasn't connecting with. And then the last part of the movie hits in which he's seen the like film about like how quickly Americans can deliver mail. And he's deciding to deliver mail as quickly as possible. And I thought that was great. Like I enjoyed that quite a bit. But the rest of the movie, I really struggled like finding a foothold. I was like, what am I supposed to be enjoying here? What is it that people are like raving about Jacques Tati, you know, as this like comic genius? I'm seeing like Family Circus level gags here in a lot of this stuff. But I really liked the like slapsticky bicycle stuff at the end. So I went on to watch...
Well, that's him doing Chaplin and Keaton.
You know? Which, I mean...
It's the American-style silent comedy.
Yeah, I mean, that's so my...
taste for that.
That's my frame of reference. Now, to be fair, I went on to watch Monsieur Hulot's Holiday. I don't know how to pronounce French. But I liked that quite a bit, and I could... It felt like much more of a full package, because it was so much sharper. Than this. And I could see like how the threads connected between like what he's doing in this film and then what he's doing in a second film. But like it was so much crisper and like more entertaining and more engaging to me, because it felt like it didn't have that shagginess and fluffy like naturalism that is kind of in this movie a little bit. And maybe some people find that appealing, and maybe I would find it appealing if I watched more Tati movies and went back to it. But I was having trouble connecting with the first like 60-70%.
Andrew's gonna make a point, but real quickly, that's literally how I think everybody responds to Jacques Tati, especially the first time. And Jour de Fête is, it's one that you appreciate more once you've seen like his work more. Yeah. So
the arc of the career. He has such an awesome, like, his movies build on each other in this amazing way. And like, for me, who's seen pretty much all the others, I haven't seen Parade, his last movie, but it was actually really incredible to see how this slots in as almost a prequel to the Hulu movies. Like it, the trajectory that he's on, like this is just another part of it. It doesn't feel like it is, you know, a different style of comedy or a totally different character. This guy could be called Mr. Hulu for all I care. It feels like it fits in the rest of his filmography. But like you said, Zach, the way that you like enter into Tati's filmography and like everybody's first Tati film is always a struggle. And I think that like where you enter does matter. A lot of people start with Playtime because Playtime is the one that's maybe the most critically acclaimed, but it's also like
Hulot's Holiday too.
Hulot's Holiday is probably the best place to start. That's where I started. And like, Tati is absolutely a director, like, you need to watch his movies in order. I mean, maybe start with Hulot's Holiday, maybe skip Jour de Fête, because it's a little tougher. But, like, his movies, they're cumulative. Like, they build on each other. And, like, I made the mistake of showing Playtime to my friend Jordan, who had never seen a Tati movie, and he fucking hated it. Like, we don't talk about Playtime. Like, he's so mad about it that I made him sit through Playtime.
No, I know. But yeah, Playtime's yeah. much...
Well, Playtime's 2.5 hours or something. And like, it's not way a good starting harder point. Than this movie. Yeah. We did it as our first Tati movie on the podcast when we probably shouldn't have done that.
Yeah, but I also, I think I watched Hulot's Holiday and Monocle before then. But it is like, it does, they do build on each other because you kind of get a sense of who Hulot is. And the thing that you kind of also start to understand as you watch these movies, and it becomes the most apparent with Playtime, is Tati has this... And this is where I think he kind of separates himself from Keaton and Chaplin, is that, to your point that you made, Michael, he is a very like modernist comedian. Like he's very aware. I mean, even in this movie, honestly, like he's very aware of like the changes that are happening to the world. So that's what makes this one interesting to me. Rewatching this,
he's literally reacting to modernism, like
exactly
architectural yeah. modernism, technological modernism. Like that's what his movies are about ultimately.
Well, and I will say that like, maybe you guys have a more nuanced take on this, but like when the like specter of like like the post-war like modern world comes into this movie is when this movie takes off for me, and when he's trying to imitate like, you know, the American technological advances in postal delivery, that's when like the movie becomes a lot more engaging for me.
Well, yeah, and that's why it was fascinating to me watching it after having seen the rest of his films, because I'm watching the first half of this movie through a totally different lens than you are, right? Like I'm seeing this like extremely provincial town and thinking, holy shit. Like this is where Jacques Tati, this is what he's interested in at the beginning of his career, right? Like he's kind of like presenting this as the ground zero of like, this is what life was like before modernism. And like every movie like adds a little bit more to it until Playtime is like this weird sci-fi dystopia. Yeah. And so like looking at the gags that he gets out of like people hammering nails into wood, like takes on a whole new meaning if you know where the arc of his career is going.
Yeah, and the thing that I love about Tati also is that he also like takes this stuff on in such a kind of an empathetic way. Like he's never going like, screw this technology or screw
this. He's not conservative. He's not saying like we need to go back to the old ways.
Mm-mm. He's very much like taking it on face value and going, I guess this is what's new now. Like I'm just trying to make sense of it. And the way he makes sense of it is also kind of making fun of it, you know, like you think of Francois and like how he reacts to that. He could have just been like, he kind of, you know, been like, whatever. But it's just like the way he reacts to it is more just got, it goes, well, I can do that. I, you know, those Americans with their planes and their in their innovations. Like I can do as good as that. It's fine. And it really like becomes more to head like later on in his films. You know, when you think of like playtime and the way he's like interacting with the technology there, and it's not that he's saying that this technology is bad. He's just more like, isn't this stuff absurd? You know, like I know why it's here, but it's absurd.
I think it does. I think, like, bad is maybe too reductive. I don't think he's saying, like, future bad, technology bad, whatever. But I do think that he is critiquing it in ways. Like, there are ways in which, like, it gets in the way of human interaction and human connection in a lot of ways. Like, I was thinking a lot about how the humor functions in this movie compared to a Chaplin or a Keaton, because it becomes Chaplin Keaton in the last 30 minutes, but the mode of joke is very different in the first hour. And I was thinking that, like, maybe the best way to explain it is that, like, Chaplin and Keaton movies are usually about people doing funny things. Like a person does something that's funny. And in a Tati movie, it's often like a person is in a funny place. Or a person, something funny is happening around a person, but they are not necessarily the reason why it's happening, right? Like, there's a scene where he's at the carnival, and he's like trying to throw like this ball at like a stack of cups or something, and he like finds himself turned around, and he's like stumbling around trying to find, you know, where he needs to be, and he finds himself in the middle of a shooting range, and like somebody's like shooting a rifle at him. He's just like a guy in the wrong place, and like that's often the situation here. Like, there's also the gag where he's like drunk and he's on his bicycle, but he's on the wrong side of the fence. His bicycle's on the other side of the fence, and he keeps trying to get on it, but the fence is in the way. And like those kinds of gags get more and more absurd as the films go on, to the point where like in playtime there's people trying to communicate through like tons of like layers of panes of glass, you know. And it seems to be suggesting like this technology is kind of like getting in the way of something that doesn't need to be so complicated, right? Even though I don't think he's conservative. I don't think he's like socially or economically conservative or anything like that, but he is kind of like questioning, like, do we need all this stuff, right? Like, go ahead.
Well, I was gonna say, I read a really good review on Letterboxd that was really interesting, kind of to your point about like comparing him to Keaton and Chaplin. And especially Chaplin, they said, is somebody who, I mean, the figure of his movies is the tramp. You know, like, it's all, everything centered around the tramp. It's all, everything, the whole aura is around the tramp, which, that's just how it is. And the thing that's really interesting about Tati is, it's not, it even with the Hulot movies, where he's, like, has his name in the title, it's not all about Hulot. Like the way, especially in this one, he's not the center of attention. He has such a economical way of, like, involving everybody else and having gags going on, like, in the periphery while he's also there, that I don't know any other filmmaker who's, like, able to capture that. Because you think of, like, one of the first times you see Francois, when he rides his bike into town and that pole is about to fall, and he rides into the restaurant, and then the bike, you know, the guy walks out with the bike and throws it, he's up on there, and the second time the guy's like, why, how did you get up there again, you know, like
you like he's see the able, cut too.
Yeah, and it's amazing, because the joke is, you have the joke of the banner falling down because people are like screwing up that flagpole. You have the joke of the guy getting rid of the bike. You have the joke of Tati up on top, and then you have the joke of like other people watching him. Like, you have so many different planes going, and I think that's different.
The jokes, like, they build on each other too, in the same way the movies build on each other. Like, There's like a three-layered joke that I love. That almost reminds me of like the way that humor works in Arrested Development, where like a joke will be made, and the same joke will be made like three episodes later, and then by the time you're two seasons later, like the joke is in its 15th iteration, and it's like this crazy thing, you know? But there's the joke where he's riding his bicycle on the path to the town, and there's a mosquito by his ear, and he's like doing the thing, trying to swat the mosquito. And there's the farmer on the hill who sees him, and he doesn't know he's trying to swat a mosquito. He thinks the guy's trying to wave at him in a weird way. And so the farmer starts trying to wave in the same way. And then later, when the marching band is coming to town, you see the guy with the cymbals trying to smash the mosquito, and you can't hear the mosquito at that point either. You just see the cymbal guy doing this weird thing, and you're like, what the fuck is that guy doing? And then eventually it clicks for you, like, oh, it's the same mosquito. It's like in that path. It's extremely funny to me. Like, just, it's a very unique brand of humor that Tati has. Like, he keys into these like types of jokes that I feel like you don't see in American comedies.
I think, like, I mean, thinking about it, I mean, I recognize the parts you guys are saying, and maybe this is a matter of training myself, but like, I appreciate the more elevated and absurd it gets when it's at the first hour of that movie and everything is so low key. Like, it's just like I mentioned, like, it's like family circus humor to me, where it's like, I see that it is, I register that this is supposed to be funny to somebody, but it's not funny to me, you know, as I'm watching these things. And then, but when it gets more elevated, I like that, you know, and not elevated in the sense that it's more manic, but like when it is intentionally more surreal and absurd. And I think that that's part of like the Monster Who Loves Holiday that I liked, is that it's way more like precisely keyed into how are you building that absurdity. Whereas this one definitely felt like just kind of like putzing around the town, like, oh, you, like, you know, yeah, like you're mentioning, like, the bike on the wrong side of the fence, and like, that's like kind of funny, but it's like the kind of funny that would be funny if I was there and not watching it in a movie, to me. And like, there's a lot of that type of sense of humor in the first bit of this movie. Like, a lot of that humor is like that, and there's like that particular sense of humor where if I would have been there, it would have been funny. But watching it in a movie,
question.
Isn't.
I have to know if you thought this joke was funny. The guy, when Tati's character, the guy trying the to hit the guy? Nail on the wood, and he keeps hitting to the left of the wood, so Tati just puts a second nail like just a little ways away from where he wants him to actually hit. So he like tries to hit that one, but hits the one that he wants him to actually hit.
I mean, that was good.
It's a good cut, yeah, because he cuts over and the guy's
I mean, that's fine, and that's good. Like, I don't know. Like, I guess, like, with jokes like that, there has to be, that being, like, the one focus right there, like, I kind of, you could see where it was going. Like, it's like, funny, kind of. Like, I don't know, it's, you know, there's, like, the funny where you kind of, like, slightly exhale through your nostrils, and then there's like funny, and it's the first kind for me.
I understand though, because it goes back to the point that I was making before, that like he's working on so many, and he gets, and it, and this becomes more pronounced as you go along, but he's working on different planes. So he has like a joke going on over here, and a joke going on over there, and a joke going on over there, and so
there's very little of that in this
movie.
Yeah,
less of it. Much more focused. There's less of it, but at the same time, like, that's how it gets, and you're just like, and I think it becomes overwhelming, because you're just like, what am I supposed to be laughing at? Because there's like all this stuff happening. So, like,
but see, I kept waiting for that, because that's what I had heard, I kept waiting for that, and I was like, this movie is empty and slow to me for so long. And not empty in like a bad way necessarily. It was like documenting like this kind of like quirky town, and like I appreciate that on that level, but it was not something I found like super funny or even like that interesting for very long, because I kept waiting for there to be like something more complex going on. And maybe it is simply contextually complex within his filmography, but it just felt like way too low-key for me.
No, like we said at the top, like, I think maybe the you know, the other Hulot movies will hit a little bit better. I feel like you'll like Traffic.
You will love Traffic. Okay, yes,
you'll,
so I was
like
thinking
Traffic.
I was thinking about Traffic more than any of his other movies while watching this. For anybody who's listening, and for Michael who don't know what Traffic is, it's like Tati's like car movie. It's set at a car show and then on the interstate to and from the car show. And it's like a supremely anti-car movie. And I was thinking about cars in the last 30 minutes, this movie, when it really gets all like Charlie Chaplin, Buster Keaton, like, I'm going to deliver mail the American way. And it's all about speed and it's all about efficiency. And this is where I feel like the movie actually has like a point of view and a critique. It's like almost criticizing like the idea of Taylorism, if people know what Taylorism is, like just the capitalist idea that like anything that can make us more money, or we can do something faster, we must do it faster, we must make more money. And like in this movie, every time he tries to do something really fast, it always ends up like either getting somebody hurt or meaning that the job doesn't get done as well. Like he throws the guy the shoes, but the guy was like working with a meat cleaver and he cuts the shoes in half. And like it seems to be suggesting that, and they talk about like that's the American way, right? And the old woman at the end is like, well, that maybe that works for the Americans, but like they can't make the crops grow any faster, right? There's a certain level of speed that maybe humans would be better operating on. And I was thinking about cars and trains, and you know, me and Michael are big train people and public transit people, and like trains are slower than cars. Cars are more efficient, they're faster, they're better if you can afford them, right? But like people die in cars way more than people die in trains, but we've decided that that's a cost that is worth, you know, living with in order to increase our efficiency. And so like this seems to be like speaking to that particular problem of you know, the idea of progress in that particular direction.
Yeah, and I do like that, like in it, like as a piece, like the movie works fairly well in showing like a town with a pretty slow pace, but nonetheless is like a functioning place thriving, like human happiness and stuff like that, that is not actually meaningfully improved by having faster mail delivery, for example. Like, and I think that that's like a nice thing that the movie does, like just on a structural level, is like the speed is a real disruption to the town that doesn't improve it at all. And I like that. And like, I mean, there's some of that too in like the Hulot's Holiday, like that I watched, and I like that a lot better because he's got that like car that's like constantly just like this car that's like gotta be from like 1915 or something like that, like, you know, and them like trying to like you know, piece like fix the car like all the time, and like all that sort of stuff is like a great way of showing that like this like modern convenience of like automobiles is can actually be a real ball and chain in some ways, because you're like now like stuck to this machine, and if the machine isn't working properly, it becomes like this huge hindrance to doing anything. And I like that. But you know, it just didn't click as well for me in this first one. So
yeah, and I do think the idea of like the humor is more of like breathe through your nose humor than laugh out loud humor is not wrong. Like I think that his jokes are much more low key, and I don't laugh as hard at his jokes as I laugh at Keaton's jokes, for example. But I think that he's like found his own little brand of humor, his own niche, and I think it really works for him. And I think it's still a valuable form of comedy, even if it's not getting the same like quote unquote returns in terms of like just how hard you're laughing per minute.
To me, I like Playtime is probably one of my favorite movies ever, because there's just something about the like, yes, you're not sitting there bowling over laughing, even though I do in Playtime because it's hilarious. But there's something about the economy that he has, where he's able to just mine from so many different places. Like, I love Keaton and I love Chaplin, but again, like they're very focused on like the physical acts that they're doing, and like that's where the comedy's coming from. And Tati's so great because he has that, but he also has the ways to just like you know, once you get the playtime and you have just that scene at the restaurant, like that's a masterclass. And just like you have six different like bubbles of jokes happening all at once.
It's like fatiguing almost. There's so many jokes and they go on for such a long time.
And that's what I had heard, which is why this movie was so, threw me for such a loop, because I felt like that there was nothing. It's not literally nothing going on, but I kept looking for these, like, where's all this, like, I'm overwhelmed by things that are on screen. And, like, I would be looking at, like, in the carnival scenes or whatever, I'd be looking all around. I'm like, is there anything else going on? And, like, occasionally there's, like, something mildly interesting, but for the most part, there's not. Like,
it's mostly close-ups, and the thing that you're supposed to think is funny is center frame.
Right, and so my feeling was just like, well, I'm not seeing a lot of the complexity that I've been told about, and then the thing that I'm that's, like, front and center is something that I'm, like, only, like, mildly amused at, and so... It had thrown me because, like, what you guys are saying is what I had heard, but I didn't find it very present in this movie.
No, and it's not totally present. I mean, there's you can feel the beginnings of what he does, but I do think that it's lesser in that extent. The one thing I do want to talk about, just like the character, because the character of Francois, like you said, is very similar to Hulot. I mean, you could put the little hat and jacket on him, and it could be Hulot. But I really love this character just kind of as like this separate, you know, thing from Hulot, because, you know, like, I just love how, like, ingrained in that community he is, as like, just who his personality is. Like, you think about when he comes to save the day with the flagpole, and he, like, kind of helps get them, you know, get them to get that thing up. And then he spends, like, the next 10 minutes anybody he runs into,
he complains that pole almost beamed
me. But then he's also bragging. He's like, you know, I came in there and I saved the day. And you know, I know those types of, like, people who are so, like, community ingrained, and it's just like they always have some story about something, like, oh yeah, they couldn't do this without me, so I had to go and help it out. And that's the one thing I love about this movie, is it just feels like such a, like, you immediately kind of go into that lived-in community of that small town, and all of those different faces and characters feel like, I mean, from the old lady to the person who owns the restaurant to the different workers, like, everybody feels so, like, lived in. And again, I think that Tati has, like, this empathy for all of these different people and allows them their moments, which is really, like, going back to the point of economy, like, he's not setting up the jokes necessarily, but he is giving all of these people, like, a time to shine, you know?
I would say that, you know, a lot of the things we've been talking about of, like, this being a lesser or smaller form of what Tati does later, because he's, like, expanding in this, like, exponential way throughout of his movies. Most of those things I don't see as negatives here. I just see this as, like, the logical starting point for the trajectory, right? But I do think that the talking, which you were just talking about, Zach, of, like, him going around and complaining to people, kind of gets in the way for me. I think that maybe is actually a con of this movie, because we were talking off mic about how all of Tati's movies are essentially silent movies, even though they all have sound, but they're performed as silent movies because you don't get extended conversations with people. When people do talk, they're either inaudible or what they're saying is so unimportant, like, you're not paying attention to it. It's all physical. It's all visual comedy. And, like, there's a lot of talking in this, to the point where it has, like, a narrator in that, like, hunched over old woman, like, the most hunched over woman I've ever seen in my life. And I actually think that the reason it kind of gets in the way, is because, A, like, when there are jokes that are just told verbally, like the joke where he walks into that lady's house after the goat ate the mail, and he's talking about how, like, well, you should ask him for the mail next time because he takes the mail. Like, I think that the goat eating the mail, us seeing that happen, is way funnier than him talking about it and, like, trying to pull a laugh out of just, like, repeating the thing out loud. Like, that he's always funnier as a visual comic than he is as a verbal comic. But also, I don't think that the Hulot character is quite as endearing in this movie because of how much talking you hear. Like, there's something kind of, like, cute and put upon about the Hulot character in the other movies, where, like, he barely reacts to the shit that's happening to him. And in this, like, not only does he react verbally, but he goes around and complains to people about it. And I like your framing of it, Zach, of, like, he's just, like, a community member who, like, this is the way of he connects to people, is, like, telling this exaggerated stories of what happened to him. But it also, like, initially read to me as, like, well, he's kind of just, like, whiny, right?
Well, yeah, but he's a guy who is not... he's not important, but he's also important. Like, he's important in the fact that all of these people like him, because I mean that's why the whole at last act of this movie works, because they're all like, oh, Francois, you know, challenging the Americans, and it's all and they're all watching him like it's the Tour de France. But I think that, like, those moments, even though those are talky moments, the woman, the old lady narrator, you know, that is what it is, but like whenever he's talking, it's still, again, he's repeating the story to everybody, so I almost glaze over it, because it's almost like the non-talking other Tati movies, because it's just him running into somebody and going, oh, that flagpole was gonna fly, and he's just like repeats the, but it's more just like the, it's more watching like how kind of like he gains this like local self-importance, you know, it's like they couldn't have done that without me, and you're like, I mean, of course they could, but it's just like this guy kind of like, this was his moment in the sun, like, you know, it's like it's just kind of this goofy guy that everybody likes, that everybody like knows the level he's at, but it's just like this was his little moment in the sun that they, and they kind of set that up, because those guys are like, well, let's get Francois, like they really don't need him, but they're like, we'll get Francois, you gotta, like, we need you to guide us, and he's just like, oh, he's like doing that. It's just I like that, like, they're very aware, and everybody's very aware of like their place in this community, and I think that's funny, and I find that very charming, and I want to live there, and I want to be the old lady who walks around with, I want to be the old lady who's hunched over with the goat.
It's like if she was leaning backwards that much, she would be doing the limbo, you know. But she's hunched over forward, but it's like a 90 degree angle at her waist.
I like the my favorite part with her was when she was just like walking like after the carnival, and she's like, I went to sleep before all of this. They must have been up late.
Yeah. I have never worn pink in my life. I always wear black.
Yeah, I think more movies could use the old lady just walking around, just talking about stuff. You know, like think of the Green Knight. If we were watching the Green Knight, or, you know, and then she was just walking around, just like, oh, what's he doing over there? And that eating those, had a nice those mead mushrooms. Pudding.
Yeah,
there are no old ladies in the Green Knight. I get it. I get the backlash now.
Exactly. Any final thoughts? I mean, Michael, are you going to try to continue on the Tati journey? Because I would recommend it.
Yeah. Like I said, I liked Monsieur Hulot's Holiday. And so, you know, as kind of ambivalent I've been about this movie, I feel like I will enjoy later movies more, because I've already enjoyed at least one later movie more.
I hope your experience is like the Vince McMahon gif of like him getting exponentially more excited, because the last one you'll probably watch is Traffic, which is the anti-car movie, and it'll be just like falling backwards.
I'm very excited about that. I didn't realize there was an anti-car movie, which is because like a primary flaw in like those early silent film dudes like Chaplin and Keaton is like most of their work was prior to the ascension of the automobile, and we didn't get to see their take on, you know.
Yeah, this is the thing that
my thing I always talk about with Tati is if I could have one movie made, it would be Tati reacting to like the iPhone.
Yes. Oh my gosh. I think Nadine has said this on the podcast before as well when we did Playtime, but like there's no director that I want to see like take on the internet or the modern era more than Tati. Like, and there are things in here that almost presage it, you know, like he's texting while driving at one point. He's on his bike and he has a telephone.
Oh, and he's got the phone. I like the phone on the bike guy. Over.
But I was wondering, like, you know, what would this, could he update this to be set in a world with like where everybody gets everything important through email, and our mailbox is just full of like junk mail advertisements from McDonald's, you know, like what is this character's life like if he's just like stuffing people's mailboxes full of coupons, you know? I think that would be funny. But my other final thought is that, you know, one of the many recurring gags in Tati movies is there's always a chair gag. And I was delighted to see the OG chair gag at the beginning of this movie, where he sits on a chair that has wet paint on it, and he gets up and he goes to sit on another chair and it also has wet paint on it. And I like how much more ridiculous those get as they get along from movie to movie.
Yeah, I'll echo what we said at the top. I don't know if this would be the best place to start. But I don't know. It's nice to come back to after you've kind of once you've understood, you kind of grasp the Tati lexicon. It's a nice one to go back to and appreciate. It's very imperfect, but I think it also is that kind of it opens up a lot of those gags that he's still doing the same stuff later in his films. There's even a chair gag in Parade. So.
Oh wow! I need to see Parade.
Jour de Fête. It's on, I think it's on HBO Max actually. If you want it, but it's also on, I would assume Criterion Channel. I have the Tati box set, so that's where I watched it. But, I think it's on HBO Max. I think it's on HBO Max if you can watch it there. But that'll wrap up this episode of Cinematary. Thank you for listening. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/cinematary, on Twitter and Instagram at @cinematary, and on Letterboxd at letterboxd.com/cinematary, where we post all the movies that we talked about in this episode. Patreon.com/cinematary. Thank you so much to our patrons: Cam, Chad Newsom, Christina Daughtry, Corey Willingham, Harry Eskin, Candace Sisson, Ron Hayes, Tyler Chandler, Whitney Rio Ross. Thank you so much for your patronage. Next week, we'll be continuing our Young Critics Watch Old Movies series by shifting to the 1950s. We're going to be talking about 1957's The Sweet Smell of Success. We're really going on a Zach's picks for a Young Critics run here, the last few. So, Sweet Smell of Success. Good stuff. Burt Lancaster.
You're gonna have to say that a lot next week.
Love me some Burt Lancaster. I gotta put the train on here next year. Anyway. All right. Thank you guys for listening. We'll see you next week.